Indeed, we built both the chips under $50 million, so it was very, very capital efficient. So I think that's going to be a record that's hard to beat, even for us looking into the future.
NXP, one of the largest semiconductor companies in the world, acquired it for $300 plus million dollars. It's the one of the largest deep tech exits our country has ever seen. I was amazed to hear about it, and also more amazed that I hadn't heard about it more.
In 2023, I was one of the first ones, some bragging rights here, that I went out and started to say, this is going to come to the edge. I had this conversation early 2023 saying, she asked me, what are you working on? We said, you know, we are working on generative AI for the edge. And she says, what are you talking about?
I'm very excited about this podcast. Welcome to another episode of Intelligent Indians on Z47 Moments. My guest today is Ravi Annavajjala. Kinara was his startup that he sold to NXP. They built chips that let AI run on any edge device, think cameras, think cars, on a factory line, on robots, and so on. And then without sending anything to the cloud. They designed and built 90% of it out of Hyderabad. And last year, NXP, one of the largest semiconductor companies in the world, acquired it for $300 plus million dollars. It's the one of the largest deep tech exits our country has ever seen. I was amazed to hear about it, and also more amazed that I hadn't heard about it more. And I thought this is a very important podcast to actually recognize this journey and really learn more from Ravi's journey. Quick background to Ravi: he's an engineer from Hyderabad, went on to do his master's in the US, West Virginia, and then also a Wharton MBA. Spent a couple of decades at semiconductor companies, Intel, SanDisk, and then was a founder of an energy startup, and I want to hear about that before he met his co-founders at Kinara and became the CEO. So it's a conversation I've really been looking forward to. So Ravi, thanks a ton for joining us. You know, I know you didn't expect this when you ran into me for a coffee in the Bay Area, but now you're on a podcast.
Awesome. Thank you for that introduction, Vikram, and very happy to be here on this podcast with you.
So we're going to cover three things. Number one, the Kinara story. Number two, where you think Edge is going, and this entire edge space, and whether it's going to stay on the edge or it's going to be mainstream AI. And three, how edge could be very, very important to the India AI solution. And so excited about this. So let's dive into your story. How did the, you know, Hyderabad boy end up in the US and then back here to found this deep tech company?
Awesome. So happy to cover that journey. I started as an engineer. I joined Intel 3 decades ago, early 90s, designing chips and managing many generations of chip designs. And then I had a bug for how business works, and I wanted to figure out how, in fact, semiconductor business works. So that took me to Wharton. I got an MBA from Wharton. And along the ways, I was able to combine both the business lens and technical lens. So that was sort of my initial part of the journey. So spent, like I mentioned, about a decade and a half in engineering. And then I had a ringside view both at Intel and SanDisk that you mentioned, where I was employed. And in both the companies, I was able to see how decisions are made when big technology transformations happen. And one of those transformations, and I think it's instructive in a way to my Kinara journey, happened in 2004, 2005. I had joined the corp dev team, biz dev team at Intel, and I was part of the NAND Flash group, which had just been formed. And in that group, in that business line, what happened was that the NAND Flash costs, the media costs, were coming down very rapidly. And we could see line of sight to intercepting magnetic media. Not only were we able to see that, there was clearly a distinct value proposition and advantage. One where the solid state media could shine both in terms of latency as well as total cost of ownership compared to magnetic media. So this was an exciting time. It was the biggest disruption that was going to happen in the compute platform, on the compute platforms. So I was not only getting a front seat view of this, but I was also part of that transformation. I did many, many deals while I was at Intel with startups and large companies. What stood out was one thing. We all think that companies have bad, large companies have bad strategies and they fail. But this was not the case. There were about a half a dozen large companies that were developing NAND flash. And these are multi-billion dollar investments they were making at that time to take on this new opportunity that was gonna come about because they were gonna displace magnetic media and add a lot of value to the platforms along the way. But the real takeaway there was that when a disruption happens and the market starts to segment very rapidly, the incumbents, the large incumbents, they are looking for smaller companies that are that have tech and talent that they want to bring on board because they're not simply not able to keep up with the pace of disruption. And this I saw because there were about half a dozen or more companies in the NAND flash controller space. These controllers are supposed to manage the media, right? So these are ASIC companies.
Yeah.
And all of them that started and were founded in the 2005-2006 timeframe when the NAND flash disruption started, they all exited for about $400-500 million all the way to $1 billion plus. There were Fusion IO, SandForce, Anobit, Apple acquired Anobit, SandForce was acquired by LSI, Fusion IO went public and was acquired by SanDisk, Smart Storage and others. And the big takeaway was that the incumbents have a great playbook, they have great strategy, but when the disruption happens, the startups have a play there as well. And this lesson sort of stayed with me. So when 2015 came along and I had just exited SanDisk at that point in time, I wanted to go back to the startup world and startup ecosystem. And one of the things that, like I mentioned, stayed with me was this lesson of how industry disruption had happened and how the startups were able to capitalize this. And one of the things that was happening at that point in time was the AlexNet had just come on and deep learning was making its yeah. way. And a lot of my peer group, the others that were the my peer group in terms of semiconductor companies that were looking to do AI were focused on data center. And this was the first major bet that we made was that as much as semiconductors and AI semiconductors are important for data center and cloud, they were going to be very important for edge as well. And the opportunity space was much, much larger than what it was with NAND flash and storage. So this led me to the founders and, the rest is history, right? As I would say. So we started the company and we exited last year.
So maybe I missed the chronology, but, at some point of time, it was called CoreViz, then it was called DeepVision, then it was called Kinara. And Kinara, for those who know Hindi, Kinara means edge. So clearly you were going for that. So it seems like there were some pivots along the way. So what was the problem statement that you started with? And then how did you end up with Kinara?
Yeah, so I'll take it in two parts. First, the problem statement. The belief was that edge AI is a theme that was gonna be there for some time and is gonna win because we felt that data had to be processed where it was generated, closer to the sensors. And the amount of data that was getting generated was humongous, and we wanted to make sure that the processing was efficient. And not only was it efficient from a performance per dollar or performance per watt as we look at it, but more importantly, it was programmable because we felt that the AI models are gonna evolve and change and evolve very rapidly. So we wanted to have a software stack that could marry the efficiency alongside the programmability. So that was sort of the vision. And we knew that while the data center and cloud players would win, there was a big play for edge AI as well. From a name standpoint, the company was called CoreViz. It was started by the two founders out of Stanford. They completed their PhD. And the big lesson or big takeaway from their PhD was that data movement is the biggest inefficiency in any compute. So how do you keep data closer to where it's generated, and also not only it's closer to where it's generated, but from a compute hierarchy standpoint and memory hierarchy standpoint, you keep data closer to the compute and not have to go traverse L1, L2, and DDR multiple times, right? Which was what we were seeing out of GPUs. So keep the data closer to where it's generated, and second is keep it closer to where the compute, the ALUs were. And they started with CoreWiz. I can't actually recall why they called it CoreWiz, but then it didn't resonate, and a year or so later, everything was becoming deep. So deep vision was what we chose. And we ran with that for a while. And then when we were raising our Series B, we found out that we were not the only deep vision. There were many, many deep visions out there. And not only were there many deep visions, it was very difficult for our investors, customers, and partners to parse which was the right deep vision. So at that point, we sort of made a decision that after we close our Series B financing, we're gonna shift over to a new name. And keeping with the Indian name and Indian tradition, we wanted to get something that resonated. And we went through a name search and we picked Kinara. And like you mentioned, Kinara means edge. So Kinara.ai is edge AI.
Awesome. At least for me, Kinara definitely resonates and much more memorable. How did you guys think about the talent ecosystem? And there's this chatter, I wouldn't call it prevailing wisdom, because the wise actually think to the contrary. And you said 90% of your talent was in India, or maybe more of the technical talent. How did you think about choosing A, Hyderabad, and B, the fact that this kind of talent in the chip as well as the AI on chip space was available in India?
So yes, indeed, 90% of the team was in Hyderabad. This was not a cost decision, primarily. So a lot of people think that we did this for cost reasons, and it did play out that way, and I'll touch on that. It was a talent decision, and I have kept up with the growth of talent in India for the last two decades. I'm a frequent visitor to India. I used to visit at least once a year, maybe multiple times a year. And I saw that there was a pool of talent that could design the chips ground up, first principles. And this is the hardest part, right? If you think about it, designing the chips ground up or the hardest part. But in the case of AI, it was not just designing the chips ground up, it was the compiler stack. Compiler talent even now is very, very hot. And I was fortunate enough to be associated with a team that had both these sets of skills, the chip design skills as well as the compiler skills. So I engaged with them as we were going through the fundraising process, and I was sort of looking at, hey, would you guys want to come on board and work on this? And there was enough excitement about AI then as there is now. And that led me to founding the team in India. Like I said, there was the consideration of cost as well. Our Series A raise was very modest. We raised only $10 million initially. Of course, there was follow-ups on that. And we had to get a chip done, and also the software built, and this was the only way we could do it.
It also sounds like you were incredibly capital efficient. You got the talent base, but how much money did you raise through this entire journey? It sounds like you raised a lot less versus somebody who would have had to build this in the US or some global talent base.
Indeed, we built both the chips under $50 million, so it was very, very capital efficient. And the primary thesis there was that the tier one semiconductor companies, the Intels and AMDs of the world, had already made their AI bets. So more acquisitions were not going to be forthcoming. So we wanted to make sure that the next set of industry leaders had an opportunity to acquire a company like us down the road. And the only way to return money to investors would be to keep this very capital efficient. So very, very conscious. And that's why 90% of the engineering was done in Hyderabad. It was a deliberate decision. We knew that the talent pool was there. We were very, very selective in who came on board. It was painful at times, but it paid off in spades at the end. So yeah, we kept it efficient, $50 million, two chips, I think. That's going to be a record that's hard to beat, even for us, looking into the future.
So how did NXP happen? It seems like, at some point of time, you needed both capital and distribution of a large platform to go after the space. So A, talk about NXT. A lot of people might not know them. And how did that partnership happen, and what learnings are there for founders building in that space?
Yes. So the deal was with NXP, $307 million all cash. And many people may or may not know this, NXP was already a partner for a couple of years before they came in and acquired us. So they understood Kinara's technology and our solution from the inside, not from a pitch deck. So that was the foundation. And we like all other good startups, we had partnerships with other companies. We had a partnership with NXP. We were looking at others also. This was something that was clicking for us well. And why did it click so well is because NXP had a very complementary product. Their processor lineup was very complementary to the AI chips that we were building. Their processors had all the ingredients that we needed, including the application processor, the DSP, the GPU, and whatnot. And we could have an independent chip sitting next to it scaling AI. So you could add one chip, two chips, multiple chips, and deliver the AI that a customer needs. So that was the genesis.
Sort of make it real for me. Did that mean that you could attack a larger segment of potentially autonomous driving or cars? What did that mean just in terms of market?
Exactly. So the combined solution could take it to both industrial IoT and automotive. These are the two segments in which NXP is really, really strong. And that opened up a big market for us initially as a partner. And of course, now that we are inside NXP, it's been even better, because when we pair our processors with the lineup of NXP's products, not just processors, they have connectivity, they have analog, they have security. We get a full solution and an opportunity to go to market with a platform that we couldn't have had before, right? And we could sell the entire kit of parts.
Awesome. I'm going to come back a little bit to this journey, but this seems like a good segue to go to, you know, what really is sort of edge and how much can you really do on the edge? And, you know, for most people, when you say AI inferencing, they are imagining either large data centers or at least a chip stack which is as large as a fridge. But then you're thinking edge compute, it's on small devices, IoT, and so on. So talk a little bit about how do you define edge, and maybe bring to life what is the power of like edge inferencing.
Yeah, so maybe I parse this into AI, which is training and inference, and then inference, which is edge and data center, right? So just to keep this simple, so there's a process in which the model, deep learning model, gets trained. And think of it this way. So if there's a child, you want to teach the child multiplication. What you would do is you will give the child a known set of problems. And then you supervise the child and say, okay, now I'm teaching you multiplication. Let's go through multiplication tables, how multiplication is done ground up and whatnot. And eventually the child learns that in a supervised fashion. Now, once that's done, you start to provide new sets of problems to the child, and the child then independently solves those problems. So the first part of it, where the child is supervised and given a known set of problems and known set of solutions and trained on that, it's called training. The second part of it, where the child is independently able to take these problems and get to solutions independently, that's called inference. So that's exactly the same way that these deep learning models or AI models work. Initially, a known set of data is presented along with the outputs, and the model is trained. In this case, training means there's a set of weights within the model, and those weights are adjusted until the inputs and outputs agree with each other. And now the model is considered trained. You take the model, and then you present new inputs, and then there are new outputs to be had, and that process is called inference. So now training is exclusively
in the domain. Very well said, and I wish it was that easy to teach my kids multiplication tables and then real world applications, but at least models work that way. Yes.
Models work that way, yeah. So now the second part of it is training inference at the in the cloud versus inference in the edge. So training is largely a domain where the compute is resident in the data center or cloud. There's some that happens on the edge, but largely, I would say more than 90% in the cloud. And then the inference itself, it can happen in the cloud, and we see that a lot. But the opportunity for the inference to happen also exists at the edge. And we are now seeing that it's the age of edge AI, where we are able to make inferences based on the data that's generated at the edge at the sensor.
And that's where I can argue that the cloud gets cheaper every year, connectivity gets faster. So why do I need edge?
Yeah, a couple of examples. So a couple of things. First is total cost of ownership. And second is latency. So when you want to have a decision made right when the data is generated, let's say you have a self-driving car, latency is very, very important. Latency means that you can make decisions
right. It could be a health situation. It could be on a machine assembly line, all of those.
Exactly. It could be a security issue in an airport. All of those can be flagged right when where the data is generated. Yeah. The round trip latency to the cloud, the network latency to the cloud is avoided completely. Second, as we are seeing it recently, the coding models that are prevalent in the cloud, the tokens are running out because of the cost. There are a cap on tokens put on by the cloud service providers and also the language model providers. So this is something where the edge can shine really, really well, because you can make one-time investment in the chips and you can reap the benefits forever, right? You don't
have to. I've heard that edge can also be a solution or potential solution for privacy concerns. Is that true or is that just marketing?
It is absolutely true. So your data is resident on your premise, and this is one of the big values that we have. So beyond the total cost of ownership, beyond latency, where you're making decisions very quickly, there's privacy and also reliability. So what if your network goes down? How are you going to make decisions, right? So that's where edge shines very, very well. And not only this, the other aspect here that you touched on is that edge is going to be part of the stack that is multi-layer, right? And at one part of the stack, we have the cloud, and one part of the stack, it's edge. And they will interoperate seamlessly as we look into the future.
So it sort of brings to life why you're saying it could be the next wave could be the wave of edge AI, because it's in the real world, it's in real world applications, they could be domain specific, and therefore in all of those, edge could potentially trump cloud AI, right? But what about the models? Is it just like a compressed model that runs on the edge, or is it purpose built, domain built? What's the current state and what's the need of the hour?
So when we started, and just to give you some idea here, especially with generative AI and LLMs, in 2023, I was one of the first ones, some bragging rights here, that I went out and started say, this is going to come to the edge. And in fact, I met with one reporter press, and then I had this conversation early 2023 saying, she asked me, what are you working on? We said, we are working on generative AI for the edge. And she says, what are you talking about? But we had this vision that all the models are going to come to the edge, and not only will they come to the edge, but they'll be very performant, accurate. But also we had the vision that they were going to be purpose-built, like you mentioned. So the state of where things are, if you take the clock back a couple of years or 3 years, we could see that all the models were in the cloud, multi-hundred million, billion parameters. But we thought that distillation was a good way, where there's a teacher model and a smaller student model, where the student model got trained by the teacher model, and we could deploy the smaller model at the edge. And I think that's one of the prevalent methodologies to bring models to the edge. The other one is compression, where you're taking these models, you're pruning them, compressing them. So that's also something that's working very well. But then the purpose-built nature of some of these things is that you take these models that are already there, they're smaller, but then you bring data that's relevant to your use case and retrain them. And that we see happening a lot also. So all these three are working in conjunction with each other, and models are improving both in terms of performance and most importantly, accuracy. I mean, you look at Gemma 4, right? It's touching accuracy levels that were hitherto not imagined. So yeah. We are seeing a set of models that are coming up that are gonna be running at the edge, that are gonna satisfy the needs of a particular application. These are bespoke models, I would say. But that's what you would need at the edge anyway. And if you need more intelligence, different intelligence, the pipe for these models to communicate with a cloud model is the next thing that's gonna get built.
So this sort of leads us into this world of physical AI, which is, edge is in the physical world. Think robots, autonomous vehicles, smart factories, all of that is sort of physical AI. And that has sort of three layers, right? And there's the hardware, the models, and the data that sort of trains or retrains these models. And when you think about where the constraint is today, is the constraint on the hardware, constraint on the model, or the domain-specific real-world data? Because there's been this promise of autonomous and robots and smart factories, but there seems to be a lot of friction. It's not where LLMs and generative AI and where that space is. So where do you think the bottleneck is today?
So the space is evolving. Clearly, compute needs are not in tune with what some of these applications need, especially robotics, I would say, right? In other cases, maybe we are generally there. So the AI compute needs are growing much, much faster than what the applications are demanding.
For training, for
inference. So primarily, I'm talking about inference. So for example, take a look at VLAs, right? Vision language action models. The compute needs of VLAs are much, much higher than what a typical edge inference provider can provide. So some of that bottleneck is clearly there. Second is from a physical AI standpoint, I believe that the data is also a bottleneck in that what we have seen so far is video data of the world, but world is not all video. What you see as a desk or a shelf behind you may be made of styrofoam, may be made of wood, may be made of metal, and the physical characteristics are gonna be very, very different. That sort of metadata that's embedded into the video data is sort of missing. And I think that's getting built up also, that layer is getting built up. And finally, the third piece is the models, right? Models themselves, they're evolving. VLAs are brand very, very new, as you know. And the question is also about architecture, whether this is gonna be a centralized architecture running one VLA or is multiple models doing multiple things, some at the very edge and some at the centralized part of the edge, right? Where there's one processor running a big model and then there's smaller things that are running at the where the sensors are, where the arms are, where the legs are. So I think this is an evolving space. Compute needs are somewhat behind, I would say. Data needs to be generated to keep up with the real world, and models are also primarily evolving. So I think I don't think I can point to a particular bottleneck, but the space is evolving, and this is the needs that are prevalent in all layers of the stack.
So from sort of edge computing to what we call the India edge in building global companies, and I want to talk about, we talked a little bit about talent, and we'll come back to that, but could the part of the India edge be this domain-specific, purpose-specific data? And for example, if you take industrial applications, whether it's factories, whether it's material science, a lot of that data exists in India factories. And could that, it exists and it is much more organized with the digital public infrastructure stack in certain domains. And so the architecture or the data architecture also exists in order to collect it. And of course, we have a lot of people which also helps in terms of the collection as well as the organization of this data. So do you think that is an edge, and how can the overall India ecosystem capitalize on that edge in this entire physical AI wave or the edge AI wave?
In fact, I think there's an edge there. And I think the industries are there and the data is being generated. It's a matter of capturing the data. But it's not just data that is the data is only one part of the solution. You should use this, India should use this data to train models that are purpose-built and that are relevant for the India stack. So that is the piece that I think is missing, where we have...
Hey, more, right? That was going to be my next part of this India edge, which is you can't become a data colony. You can't just export this data and then it gets used by the world for their purposes. But how can you use take that data and build domain-specific, purpose-specific, India-specific models? And it helps us sort of catch up and potentially lap the world.
Yeah, so this is a gap and this is an opportunity also simultaneously, both for policymakers as well as for institutional VCs like Z47, is to go in and say, okay, we have this, all this data is being generated. How do we go off and have a set of companies that can capitalize on this data, build models that are purpose-built for the India ecosystem, and how do we monetize that, right? So that gap is there, and that's an opportunity for both policymakers and investors to step in and invest in.
Honestly, I have framed it as a hypothesis, but hearing it both from you, and I just did another podcast with Rahul Chari, who's the one of the co-founders of PhonePe. I heard the same thing from him. That actually makes me believe it's possible, and it's not like a VC pipe dream. So very, very, very heartening to hear. When you think of...
One thing I wanted to add there, Vikram, sorry to interrupt. So I think the infra also has to keep up. Today, I think if I look at it, infra is probably in the less than a gigawatt. We have to probably go an order of magnitude up in terms of training infra and data center infra. And the GPUs are probably also scale more than an order of magnitude. So that build out of infra is going to be very important, because this way you don't get to export all your data to a cloud that is offshore, and then keep the data onshore, train onshore, and use the models onshore.
So I was going to come to that as my next question. When you think of, if you say one thing we could do, it sounds like that one thing you're saying is actually invest in compute and keep that compute local. Other than that, is there something non-intuitive or large that we as an ecosystem could do?
I think the ecosystem, especially from a chips and infra standpoint, is at all levels. It's design services, EDA tools, VLSI, and then of course, risk capital that's patient, right? I mean, that works over a longer time horizon. And on top of it, we have the compiler stack, and then, you know, data and models, right? So the investment has to be at all layers of the stack. And I think from a silicon standpoint, I'm biased there. I think the patient capital
when
has
you say
to-
silicon standpoint, does that mean is it enough to say that we have the design talents and the design services talent, or do we need fab locally? What would you sort of invest in that ecosystem?
I mean, obviously having fabs locally is going to be super helpful, because what ends up happening is that if you have design and design services next to fabs, you can optimize your designs better. But fabs, as you and I know, are a very long-term bet. It's going to take a while for a fab to come up. And so we'll have to play with the hands that we got, right? So,
yeah.
But nevertheless, I think absolutely having fabs closer to design and design services, it'd be a great benefit.
So compute seems like a big gap. You are a clear believer that the talent exists, and then there's
yes.
of course capital, so I don't want to let myself off the hook. So what would be your advice on, there's obviously not a large VC ecosystem that's invested in hardware or semis and so on. And one of the things that will be open VC struggle with is the long gestation cycle of this, right? And because there isn't a lot of VCs here who actually have gone through the semiconductor world, it's harder for us to say, hey, we are going to invest for 4 million for 4 years through multiple cycles at the minimum tens of millions of dollars before you see a product. So A, what is your advice to VCs to think through that journey? And second, what are milestones that I should think of along the way?
Yeah, so advice to VCs is you have to have conviction, right? I mean, that's the only way it's gonna work. You say, okay, I'm gonna deploy tens of millions of dollars in this industry. And what I would watch out for, I mean, I think, and some of this is materializing, is there local demand, right? Typically, what India has done is, hey, I'm building products or services, I'm gonna want to export it. But if there's local demand, it, this is gonna be a sustainable story. Versus if the local demand is lacking, then it won't. And I firmly believe that there's massive local demand and it's exploding. And there are new products, new services that are coming out, and that gives me hope. So the things that I would watch out for are, you know, for the companies that I've invested in, are they able to secure design wins in local markets, be it defense, be it space, be it automobile. I mean, automobile sector is growing very nicely in India. Then industrial and IoT and other spaces, right? So
you know, that's a great point. Honestly, I didn't think of it. And one of the things that happened with the it happened with the SaaS and software space and a little bit of the local ecosystem around AI is that because we had large customers, the likes of Razorpay and Grow and Swiggy and Zomato and PhonePe and all of these. Because of that, the technology ecosystem actually got a big fillip by saying that, hey, there is this demand that exists and these companies are as big or larger than global companies. And therefore, the software AI ecosystem could sell to these companies, could co-develop with these companies as design partners. You're saying that the design partners for Edge actually exist in India because India is a huge demand market. And honestly, I didn't think of that. So I think that's a fantastic point. I think this is a fantastic conversation. I just want to sort of bring to life some of the things that you said. One is, sounds like there is a next wave is towards Edge AI. There is an India Edge, which is talent, which is data that could go towards domain-specific purpose-built models. And we need to play our cards right. Compute is obviously a big form factor, a big gap. And if you have local demand that could act, which is in industrials, in defense, in space and so on, that's actually a fantastic place for local deep tech companies to start. Anything I'm sort of missing in, when you think of that picture and that view of the ecosystem?
Yeah, I think, and then I would couple that with the frugal innovation, right? How do you get these chips done faster and cheaper? And
so you made it, and maybe we'll end with this, which is you made a distinction between frugal is not cheap, right?
It's not cheap.
And so how do you make that distinction and how do you explain that to the world?
So I have to actually think about it for a moment. So cheap innovation is not sustainable. That's how I think about it.
Yeah.
And frugal innovation, in my opinion, is a sustainable innovation where you're able to take the methodologies, you're able to, so what you're doing is you're able to build a sustainable competitive advantage by doing this in a cheap fashion, where you're able to reuse, repurpose whatever you're started with, versus cheap may be a one-off, right? And that, you know, it's like a hack. That's how I would characterize it. So
The other thing when people say cheap is also to say that talent is low cost, but it also means it's low capability. That is just not true. And that's what you're saying.
Yeah, that's not true. And by the way, we one thing you will probably observe is that if I have to capitalize on just that, right? Meaning, you know, low cost labor, I think that's, that story is not true anymore. I mean, if you want to get top class talent, you have to pay top dollars. And you know, one of the other things that we did a bit differently is we rewarded all our initial employees and even subsequent employees good equity, right? And I think that's becoming a bit of a more of a common theme right now, which I'm very, very happy to see. So that's how you bring on top talent, and they will see you through in good times and tough times.
Awesome. Ravi, any closing thoughts from you before I close out this conversation? It's just been a fantastic conversation, and I can keep going on. But I'd love to hear some closing thoughts.
I mean, I think the big few thoughts, you captured them. India is on the cusp. You know, we are seeing that from an AI standpoint, we have a phenomenal amount of queries. They are top, from a reasoning depth, they are top five worldwide. Then coding queries are 3x the global median. And we are also seeing that data analysis is 4x global median. We are seeing 100 plus million weekly ChatGPT users. So clearly the AI demand is there, the AI consumption is there. But the penetration is still, we are far from the top, right? Although we are 100 million plus weekly active users, we are like, I think 75th or 76th in terms of penetration. So there's a structural gap, and that gap actually is something that you guys, Z47 and other top VCs can go address. And in order to address this, there's a infrastructure gap that has to be filled as well. And the infrastructure has to go up an order of magnitude from where we are. And the way to address that infrastructure gap is twofold. One is obviously get more GPUs and build out the infrastructure. The other way to think about it is that it's a continuum from edge to cloud. So invest as much in the edge as you're doing in the cloud. So you will reduce the GPU demand. You can build and source locally and do more compute more efficiently and at the place that the data is generated. The opportunity is huge, and it's in the hands of VCs, entrepreneurs, and policymakers to go capitalize on this.
That's awesome, Ravi. Very inspiring and very well said. Thank you for the conversation. And you know, people always ask me, where are these, you know, deep tech stories? Where are the stories of companies getting built in semiconductors and so on? Here you have it. This is one. And Ravi, thank you for sharing it with us. Kinara is clearly a example of potentially the chip architecture being conceived in a Stanford dorm, but being brought to life in India, essentially built out of Hyderabad, and a great acquisition at the end of it. This conversation leaves me with a lot of hope. And if I take away one thing, it is that the AI inferencing for the physical world is being built right now, and the opportunity for India to structurally play a big role in that, in the physical AI world and building for edge AI, is big, and it's here and now. Thank you for sharing that, your story, as well as inspiring us. Thanks, Ravi.
Thank you, Vikram. It's my pleasure.
You're watching Z47 Moments, the podcast by India's oldest venture capital firm, Z47. If you like this episode, consider hitting the subscribe button and the bell icon so you never miss an update from Z47 Moments.